From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. My guest today is truly one of one. There is no one quite like him in the entire world. He has carved out a career that holds no precedent. His job titles are ever-evolving, having served as a load organizer, and most notably MC for nearly every major skydiving event in the world. He is also a television presenter, mime, actor, painter. Most impressively is his range of work as a featured presenter in all manner of air sports, events which include boogies, indoor skydiving championships, drone championships, hot air balloon races, skydiving world championships, canopy piloting competitions, major kite festivals, and sports symposiums all over the world. In all, he has over 5,000 hours of live presenting, more than 9,000 jumps that have taken place in destinations like Alaska, Dubai, Qatar, the Maldives, the Seychelles, Costa Rica, and of course, jumping into the blue hole in Belize. Remarkably, this introduction doesn't encapsulate his entire CV. Please welcome to the 20-Minute Call podcast, the voice of skydiving, Mr. Regan Tetlow.
Thank you very much, James. Great to be here and so good to see you.
Oh, Regan, great to see you. I'm so grateful for your time. I often, when I click into Facebook, I go, where in the world is Regan today? Today, you're in Sheffield, and you just come off of a weekend of live theatre performance.
I have indeed. Yes, on the other side of the UK, near my hometown in Manchester. It was a 24-hour play. It's an annual fundraiser that they do at the Hyde Festival Theatre. It's as it sounds, it's 24 hours from start to finish, from conception, from writing, from rehearsal to performance, all done by six plays in 24 hours.
You like a challenge. What I enjoy about you is you throw yourself into maybe uncomfortable situations and you seem to thrive in the nervous energy of being outside of your comfort zone. You know, it seems right that skydiving just fits you. Your personality. It's part and parcel with everything else you're doing.
Yeah, that's true. That's one of the reasons I started. Well, one of the reasons I continued skydiving after my very first one was this whole concept. I've said it before in other interviews, but it's that line, it's that concept of finding your barrier, finding your limit, your line in the sand. I'm very interested in that and what we can all achieve. Depending on where we're from or how we're brought up or, you know, what social economic group we're coming to, some people have a greater belief about their own potentials for achievement than others. And I certainly didn't. You know, I'm from a little working class town where, you know, people just get jobs. They leave school, get a job, get a trade and just then get a family and carry on like that. Not everybody, but, you know, there's a high percentage of people that might settle for that type of life. And I was very interested in that, even when I was younger, looking at others that had achieved and done things. And I thought, I wonder why we don't do that. I wonder why people from around here are not doing things like this. And so then when I did that first jump and I realized that people were doing this as a hobby, they were going every week, that was very interesting for me. And I thought, well, I wonder if I can do this. And my first thoughts were, well, of course not. You know, people from where I'm from don't do this. You know, it's almost embarrassing to suggest that I could be part of this group. Look at them. They're nothing like me. You know, they're everything they're doing is so alien to what I'm doing. But I enjoyed being around them and they seemed to enjoy being around me. So I did another jump and another jump. It was almost like the skydiving was secondary. I was just doing it. I was doing the jumps so I could be with these people because I felt like I was bettering myself, you know? I didn't really, I mean, it was all right, the jumping, but I was terrified of it. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't enjoying it that much. I was quite aware that the adrenaline and the rush that I had afterwards was more of a case of the fact that I was still alive other than the fact that, you know, this was an incredible thing I was doing. And it took me quite a while to settle down and to actually start enjoying jumping out of planes. I remember distinctly, I'd just got my license, just over 40 jumps, about 50 jumps, and we were all sat in the pub one Saturday night, and I felt like a complete charlatan. I felt like a complete imposter, and I said, I'm going to have to come clean with these guys. I'm just putting myself through this terror every week, you know, and they seem to be all just natural and completely in love with it, but I've got this big dilemma going on, this fear. So I said, guys, I need to talk to you about this. You know, I said, basically, I'm absolutely terrified. I love being here. I love being with you guys. You know, the excitement of being in the air and being in the sky and under the parachute. But I'm absolutely terrified every time. And I have to really fight hard not to turn away. In fact, I did once. I drove to the gates of the drop zone an hour and turned away and went home. I said, it's a big, big, big problem for me. You know, I don't know if I'm just being an idiot by carrying on with this and fooling myself. And their reaction was, are you serious? And I was like, yeah, I know, right? And I said, no, this is it. You're meant to be terrified. We're terrified. Everybody's terrified. It's meant to be. That's what gives it, that's why it's so good. That's what gives it the thrill. And, you know, you'll find the more and more you do it, knowledge dispels fear, and it's true. So that was kind of my early start into it, to take this back full circle with the acting as well. Various different acting things I've done, and presenting as well, absolutely with presenting. Putting myself in a situation where I think, no, I can't do that one. The things I'm doing now, but this other opportunity, that's way beyond what I can do. But then that just little light in the back of my head says, no, this is your programming. Your programming is telling you can't do it. Just do it. You can do it. And I am yet, I think, to come across an obstacle that I can't do in that, in those fields. So onwards and upwards, eh?
Regan, had I read your bio to your 15-year-old self, what would you think?
This is a very good point you make, James, because this is actually a conversation me and Rich Grimm have on many occasions. We've had a big conversation about it, but every now and again we'll be together and we say our 10-year-old self, actually. We always say, what would your 10-year-old self think of today? They would not believe it. If I was to say to my 15-year-old self or my 10-year-old self what I'm doing, they would not believe it. They would not believe it's possible. They would not believe that I could have travelled and done the things that I've done. I don't know what... How would they... Let me try and think about it, actually, in all seriousness, what they would think. Maybe they would believe it a little bit because it's got to be there, hasn't it? It's got to be there in me. But you could probably spend an hour with a psychologist working on this. But for sure, their initial impression would be one of disbelief, absolute disbelief that somebody from where I'm from could have done these things.
And you're from Stalybridge, which is just outside of Manchester. Because you're saying, wow, this is so beyond what I could have dreamed, so beyond what everyone around in this town would have thought. Describe growing up in Stalybridge. Why is this such a moonshot?
It's a very industrial town, very working class town. It's a beautiful place at the foot of the Pennines. Actually, when I go back and visit, you see with different eyes, don't you? When you visit your hometown from a different view, you actually see just how absolutely gorgeous the area is. It's the Pennines, the backbone of the UK, are in the background there, and it's this valley with this, what was a mill town at the Industrial Revolution. The cotton industry came from there. With it being that way, you know, it's not a major city, it's not a university town, it's a small little rural town. Like Rich Grimm says, he grew up in Pittsburgh. You know, we have a lot of common points along our way, me and Rich Grimm. And he says there's people in his hometown as well that never travelled anywhere, don't do anything. And I don't want to give Stalybridge a hard time. I'm just giving, this is my own personal perspective on it. My ambition when I was coming to finish school didn't really exist. I didn't really have ambition. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I know I loved acting. If I was to say what I wanted to be as a little one, I wanted to be either an astronaut or an actor. So, and I was so interested in aircraft and aviation. So I suppose somewhere along the line, I'm kind of getting there a little bit. Yeah, Stalybridge, growing up there, was fine. And we had a great time. We were outside. whenever possible. There was a lot of fields and a lot of ravines and rope swings and trees. So we spent a lot of time out in the nature because that's where we were. And it felt natural. It felt that's what we should be doing. On an academic level or academia level, I didn't really know anybody who went to university. None of my family went to university. My parents had labouring jobs, normal jobs. My eldest sister, she went into kind of blue-collar work, really. She was working in a bank and then started her own business. So she's always been a big inspiration for me that, you know, things could be achieved. But it was just one of those places. And I'm sure there's millions of places around the world like that just now. You must know places as well, James, from your childhood. You know, there's places where people just seem to naturally strive and achieve, and other places where it's more natural just to go into employment and get a job.
How many siblings do you have, and what did your parents do?
I've got two older sisters, so I'm the baby of the family. Sue and Carol, they're both older than me. They came to the play down at the Hyde Festival Theatre, the 24-hour play the other night. So good to see them. And my mother, my mother, she spent a lot of her working career in a cotton mill. The cotton industry was very strong. Then she went into working in the hospital, which she really, really enjoyed. So she was an auxiliary nurse. So that's not a qualified nurse, but helping out the nurses on the wards. And she really, really enjoyed that. But interestingly enough, when she was a young teenager, she was a singer. And she used to sing with big bands on the stage, you know, big like Count Basie type Frank Sinatra bands. She actually got offered a recording contract in London when she was 15 by a quite well-known producer at the time. But, you know, I've just thought about this for a long time. I'm thinking about it now. She didn't do it. So that opportunity came. And I always said to her, do you ever regret that, not taking that opportunity? And she says, well, sometimes, but then I wouldn't have had you, would I? I wouldn't have had my kids, and I would have gone. And her father, he was an entertainer. He was called Billy, and he was from the stage. He was always in productions and things. So that's probably where I get it from. But maybe there's that thing about my mum having that opportunity and not taking it. Maybe that's one of my drivers, you know? Never really thought about that before. My dad, he always had manual labour jobs. He was a builder. He was in the army, of course, earlier, and then he was in Africa with the army. But then he was a builder. He was in the building trade, and then he was a factory worker.
If you're a DZO or DZM listening to this podcast, and you're not using Burble, I've got a question. Why not? If the reason is price, what's the cost of your time? Other booking and manifest softwares are a one-size-fits-all. Burble was built from the ground up by a DZO for DZOs to maximize efficiency. Now, isn't that nice? There's no software that compares. Choose Burble.
Burble.
You know what I really admire about you, Regan, is if I were to plot your life from Staleybridge to today, little points on a graph paper, it's as if every job that you took, it advanced you and it opened up another door and another door and another door and another. And I'm amazed by your level of flexibility. Like most people are, I'm going to be this. This is what I'm going to do for my career. And your life has not been like that. Could you name most every job that you've worked from when you were young to today?
Yeah.
In bullet point form, yeah?
Yeah, I left school. Didn't know what to do. Wasn't sure whether to go to university, college, or what to do next. And I knew I was interested in art. I was an artist. You know, that was my skill at school. And I went to the job centre with a friend just to have a look around, what opportunities there might be, with no kind of goal in sight. Everything I've done has never been with a goal in sight. I've just kind of almost fell into the next thing. So they said, there's a guy in the next town, a little art studio looking for a trainee, as they were called then, commercial artist. And now we refer to them as graphic designers. So this was just before the invention of the Apple mic. And so I went to do an apprenticeship with him, just me and him in the office. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot about design and about composition and typesetting and letter set in that first year. It was in the second year where we went to a seminar for the introduction of this new machine, this new computer, the Apple Macintosh. And it was an absolute revelation. The things that we could do on a piece of paper could be done in seconds. So typesetting, putting lines down, all these other bits of design at the very early beginning of it. Very interesting time. And that was a really fun job. I really enjoyed it. I was moving forward with that. But I was also working part-time in a pub and in a nightclub as well. I've got a great story how I started working in the nightclub. Do you want to hear that?
I most certainly do.
I just left school and I went to this nightclub and paid to get in there, and I'm just in there, and I was underage. I was 16, I think, or something like that. Meant to be 18, really. Don't tell anybody. And so I had a beer, and I'm just thinking, this is absolutely boring. I don't understand why this is good. And I saw a friend of mine from school, and he was wearing a white shirt, black trousers, and he had a black bow tie. And he had a load of glasses in his hands, in his fingers, in his glasses, and he was going around picking them up. And I said, hey, what are you doing? What's happening here? He said, I work here. And I said, what do you mean you work here? What do you do? He said, well, I go around, I collect the glasses off the table, I take them to the bar, they take them from me, they wash them, and I go back and do another round. So I said, so just a minute, you don't pay to get in, do you? He said, no, of course I don't pay to get in. I get in for free, and I get paid to be here. I said, so you're getting in here for free, you're getting paid to be here, and you're spending all night walking around the tables, talking to all the girls, introducing yourselves. He said, yep. I said, right, who's the boss? He said, that guy over there. So I went straight up to him. I said, whatever his name was, called him Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers, I want to do that job that he's doing. He said, okay, start next Friday. And that was a revelation for me. I suddenly realized that all these things that you can do for fun, a lot of them, people might pay you to do them. And that was a big revelation. I thought, this is a game changer. So all of a sudden, I'm in there. And I was doing that job, walking around, picking up the glasses, chatting with people, being charismatic, having a great time, meeting all these new friends. And I could see the other versions of me stood on their own, looking bored, looking not knowing what to do with a beer in the hand, spending all their money. I thought, wow, this is definitely the other side of the coin. And then I did a little bit of DJing there as well before we opened. I learned how to use the decks a little bit. And then I got a job in a pub as well. And then this was another major change, which caused a big upset with the family. I got offered by the guy who ran the pub to take over the pub, to manage it for him. Actually, it was another pub he had two. And so in my parents' eyes, I was giving up this career in advertising, this career in graphic design, to go and work in a pub. But I did it, and he was offering me 5 times what I was getting paid as a graphic designer. So, you know, stupidly or not stupidly, I don't know, I went to do it. I actually spent 14 years in that pub. I bought it from him. Sorry, eventually he was retiring and I bought it. So it was my pub. But I was there for 14 years. And I sometimes look back and think, wow, those 14 years from being 18, 19 to our mid-30s, you know, that is a big, 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 big waste of time. I could have been doing many, many things. But I never really, again, this confidence thing, this ability, which I'd not learned yet, that you can achieve more. I just assumed that's all I could do. I could have gone and worked in Spain behind a bar, doing what I was doing. I could have been doing many, many things. But definitely starting skydiving, that opened my eyes to more opportunities. So anyway, these bullet points of work. There was that. I met a girl. She was living in another part of the country. And I had an opportunity of either leaving the pub, going to another part of the country to live with her, to get married, or her giving up her life to come and live with me in the pub. So we decided on the first option. So I sold myself out of the pub, moved to the northeast of England, started doing some temping jobs, and then started doing a sales job for a train company, moved up through that, still doing skydiving at the time, competing and stuff. And then I was working, I got a job for a recruitment firm. I was in recruitment. And it was then that I got offered an opportunity by my local drop zone. They had a university club jumping there. They were going down to Empuria Brava in Spain. And they said, will you come with us? We'll pay your way. Just do some one-on-one coaching with us and look after us a little bit. Because I'd been in Empuria Brava a lot over those years. And I said, yeah, let's go. So we went, we had a great time. And it was there that the next bullet point comes in when I got offered a job there. So they were looking for a couple of roles, actually. They wanted somebody as a main load organizer doing big ways and that type of thing. And then they wanted somebody else as more of a kind of front of house type role, looking after the younger jumpers, load organizing the little five ways, six ways, that type of thing, making sure they were buying packing tickets or spending the money and not keeping the money in the pocket. So if they're on their own, they might turn up and do two jumps, but with me, they might do four, and they might do packing, get the packing tickets as well. So just try and increase trade a bit. And that was a strange one because I was 33, I think, or 34. My first thought was, going to be being a full-time skydiver? It's a bit of a, it's not really an advancement. It's a bit of a kind of a joining the circus. Surely that's what you do when you're a teenager, you know, or your early 20s. Am I being a bit childish or a bit kind of irresponsible to go and do that at my age? And especially I had this great recruitment job. So I was earning money from that. I had my savings from the pub. So, you know, I was in a good place. And I knew I wasn't going to get paid much for being a skydiver. So I thought, I don't know what to do. And then I had a little recognition, little moment of thought. And I thought to myself, if I don't do this, then I'll be back in the UK. It'll be the winter time. And I'll be very regretful that I'm not on the beach in Spain, jumping out of planes and getting paid for that. So I said, yeah, let's do it. And I did. I remember the final conversation I had before I left their office. These were the owners of the drop zone at the time. I said to them, we'd hammered it all out. We'd hammered out the work, what I was going to be doing. But we'd not talked about the money. I said, oh, by the way, I had the door half open. I was half out the door. I said, how much am I going to get paid for this? And they just laughed and said, oh, not a lot. So I said, whatever. So I left without even knowing how much I'd get paid. But I was kind of obviously sure it was going to be enough to pay the rent, buy the food and have a nice life living in Spain, which it was. And so I was doing that for quite a while. Go.
Let me pause you there, Regan. You know, as we're going through the narrative,
yeah,
we can't understate, this is a major life decision.
Mm-hmm.
You're leaving, I guess at this time, you're still reasonably a newlywed.
Ah, I've just got divorced.
Okay.
So it's a very short wedding.
But you are literally leaving all that is secure and comfortable behind, you know, which some people would look as to be a skydiving bum in Spain.
Yes, exactly. It's a crazy move, eh?
I mean, can you imagine where you would be today if you hadn't said yes to that?
Uh-huh. I mean, there's so many points along the way, right?
It is truly as if, and of course, your story moves on to offer to Dubai and then a whole nother world of opportunity there. One thing I want to bring us back to, again, another major decision is really a crossroads moment, is making that first jump because of, for a local charity jump for a young lady named Mandy Turner, and they were needing a CAT scanner in your town. And you're a pub owner at this time, and you and a few of your mates go and make this jump. I mean,
yeah.
Another, like, had you not made that decision, we're not even speaking right now.
Mandy Turner, her legacy is very strong for me. She's changed my life. You know, she lost her life and changed mine. She died when she was in her early 20s, and we raised, I think we raised about £3,000 towards that CAT scanner. And that, again, you know, another one of the major changing points of my life. Absolutely. Yeah.
Remarkable. Then your world opens up to Dubai.
Well, this is another major change because I've got a comfortable life. I'm living in Spain. I've got a salary. I'm jumping out of planes. Then I start to get a few different opportunities. And the first one, there was a competition in Spain, a canopy piloting event called the King of Swoop. And that had been going for a few years. And I arrived there, I'm working there from 2004, and I think it was 2005, or it might have been 2006, coming up to the next King of Swoop. They wanted an announcer. So this goes back to my DJing from the pub days. I was used to using a microphone. So they said, look, do you want to do that? Do you want to stand on the beach and announce these canopies? And at the time, I was doing tandems as well as load organizing and AFF. And my first question was, do I get out of doing tandems? I said, yes. I said, I'm in. I don't care what it is. Don't give me a break from the tandems. I never really enjoyed doing tandems. And so then the next thing, I'm on the beach and I've got a microphone in my hand and I've got a piece of A4 paper with the names of these parachutists, these canopy pilots. And that was that. So they started to come through and we did that competition. I think it was 2 years running, maybe 3 years running. And then we fast forward a little bit to 2009. And unbeknown to me, the people in Dubai, this is before Skydive Dubai existed, but the Crown Prince at the time had got into skydiving and he decided to he wanted to do an international championships, the first ever Dubai International Parachuting Championships. And they wanted an English announcer for that. And it just so happened, another one of these moments of serendipity, that the guy they got to organize the course and to set up the competition was Renier Boss, who was the same guy who had set up the King of Swoop Championships in Spain. So he got in touch with me and he invited me to go and join this event in Dubai, which I did, which was an annual event. So that opened up more opportunities for me. And it was while I was there, actually, that I had another little revelation. The iPhone was quite new and I had mine. And the first thing I realized was, as well as pictures, you could do video on the iPhone. So I was doing some little videos of the waves or the beach or whatever. And then I realized that I could upload those videos to Facebook. So as well as uploading photographs, you could upload videos. And nobody was doing that at the time. Nobody had put videos on Facebook. And this is well before Instagram stories. This is well before any kind of these stories that people could do themselves. And so I suddenly realized that as well as commentating this event, what I could do is do little interviews with the competitors and upload those videos when I was back at the hotel at the evening. And so almost doing a little news report of the event, which no skydiving event had at all. And I started to do that and it was incredibly well received. You know, people could get a feel. Were you watching them, James?
Here's the thing. I wish you could see my notes. So I first met you in 2000, either 8 or 9, it must have been 9. And it was at Carolina Fest at the boogie that I was hosting at Skydive Carolina. And I believe it was your first year with us. I think you came 2 or 3 times, I think.
Yeah.
I remember as a marketer going, wow, Regan has cracked a code. You were doing Facebook and uploading your videos. And the value that it brought to me as an event organizer for people on the outside to actually feel the energy beyond the photos that were just being published. And you would bring the energy and you'd go into an LO tent and you'd, you know, have a chat. It was brilliant. I thought, I've never seen anybody do that before. It was so good, Regan. And it brought so much added value to us. You were definitely ahead of your time.
I remember the conversation we had. I think it might have been on the final day. You invited me into your office and you sat me down and asked various questions about how I'd done this and where I'd come from. And you were the first person that actually showed an interest in my background and how I'd got to where I was. It was very interesting. I can remember that conversation now. What is it, 15 years ago or something like this?
Yeah, about 15.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. So clearly people in Dubai see the value. It's not hard to spot in what you're doing at the end of these days.
And not just that, the FAI, the Federation Aeronautic International, the World Airsports Association, they became very interested. And they started to invite me to one or two things. And the first thing was the World Games in Cali, Colombia. That was the first World Games I got to do. So the World Games, for anybody who doesn't know, it's kind of the feeding route for a lot of Olympic sports. So sports which are not already in the Olympics or are not quite going to be in the Olympics or are trying to get in the Olympics, they'll come through the World Games. So it's quite a big organization, and air sports has had quite a big footprint in the World Games over the years. When I first got involved, they had canopy piloting and I think it was paragliding accuracy. Yes, those were the two sports I was covering then. With the World Games, I was there 2013, and then 2017 was in Wrocław in Poland, and then the last one was in Birmingham, Alabama, last year or the year before, I think it was. So that's been a good thing. But then the FAI started to get me involved in their annual conferences. So I was being the MC for those. And drone conferences. They started to do some drone conferences, which I got involved in. So all these things started to open up. That's when it all started to become a reality. And then also the world of social media with Facebook and live video started to mesh together. The first one being Periscope, which was from Twitter. That was the first live possibility that existed. It feels like it was so long ago, but it's not really. And I was commentating the Sunpath Open in Rayford, North Carolina. And I thought, while I'm commentating this, I can hold my phone. I can go live on Twitter with Periscope and people can actually watch the event live on social media. I think we had one person watching and then nobody and then two people and then nobody. And I always remember somebody saying to me, why are you bothering doing this? There's nobody watching. I said, well, there will be. Maybe not at the moment there isn't, but this is definitely the way it's going to go. And then Facebook Live became a thing, and then YouTube Live became a thing, and then the tunnel competitions suddenly realized there was an opportunity to broadcast their events live through social media. So then I was asked to come and host them. So it all started to come at once and all started to snowball together.
When you went to Impura Brava, you were in your early 30s.
Yes.
Social media, you know, by 2009, and, you know, you're not the young kid embracing social. You're the older kid.
Yeah.
Mastering it to your advantage.
Uh-huh.
You know, kudos to you, because it's clear to me that you have an open mind to just a hunger to learn.
Yes.
And provide value. Tell me, the word serendipity has come up many times this morning.
Mm.
Why do you think that there has been so much serendipity in your life? I have a theory. Curious to know what yours is.
That's a good question, James. That's a good question. Is it just, you know, I've not really thought about it. I feel like it's just all been luck, but I'm sure there's more to it than that. Is it recognizing opportunity? Is it seeing something which could be the next move? I don't really know, because I don't think I've ever had any kind of master plan of what to do next or what to move forward. But I've always, I think, recognized where there's been opportunity and thought, do you know what? I'm just going to go for it. I'm very aware that life is quite finite. My father died when he was younger than I am now. So I've never been one to worry about, oh, what if that doesn't work? I've never worried about that at all. You know, in a maximum of 100 years, we're all dead. So it doesn't matter whether things work or not, does it? You know, you can always go in, if everything goes to rot, you can always go and work at the airport or go and get a factory job, you know? So I've never been one to think, oh, I can't do that because it won't work. That kind of goes against what I was saying earlier, though, doesn't it, a little bit? What's your theory?
My theory is that your willingness to say yes, yes, not like, Regan, we have this opportunity for you. Would you be willing to try? There's not this. Oh, like, yeah, all right. And then when you do it, it's with so much enthusiasm that it's infectious. You make people smile, which is what we all want to be doing. You have this ability to connect, and people want that. I want more of that. I want that at my event. I want that enthusiasm. The question I have for you now, Regan, is because you're doing so much of it, before it was, oh man, I'm cutting my teeth. I'm cutting my teeth. You know, I just want to do more of this, and I'm grinding. Well, now the grind is not, I mean, the grind continues. You're an entrepreneur, but you are getting booked a lot. And I observed you maybe at the end of last year doing the Kite Festival. I believe it was in Qatar. And yet another festival right after it. And you were there for weeks. And we're not talking about skydiving. We're talking about flying kites. And here's Regan on stage, day after day after day after day, bringing it. And I'm thinking, how's he doing that? That's got to be exhausting.
It was a month, 28 days. It was actually four separate events. So there was, first of all, was the International Kite Festival, which I've done for a few years now. And that's such a great, great, great gig to be at. The kite flyers are so much fun, and the spectacle of them are beautiful. And my role is, there's a big stage with entertainment all afternoon and all evening. So my role there is to MC all that. So I am a MC for the crowd, all the people there, and I'm introducing the acts and telling people about the kites and getting the kite flyers or their teams to me when they can to explain to the people about where they go flying kites and how the kite industry became a thing and kite events. So that is really, really cool. After that, it was the FAI 6 Worlds championships of paramotor slalom. So that was a new one for me, and we were broadcasting a live feed for that. Also, there was the opening of the brand new Qatar Air Sports Museum, which I was doing a live presentation from and doing interviews for that as well. And then on top of that, kind of overlapping all of them, it was during the Qatar Expo, and there was an international food festival there. And as part of the food festival, every night there was a paramotor pyrotechnic exhibition. And so they wanted me on the stage to MC and announce all that and to, you know, do the crowd work, which was probably the biggest stage I've ever been on. It was absolutely massive. It was another step forward, you know, with a different type of budget from Air Sports. This is a food festival, their international food festival, which is millions and millions. So it was an incredible stage to be on. So yeah, it was 4 weeks of fun, but 4 weeks in a hotel, it's quite a lot to be away in one place.
If you're a fan of the 20-Minute Call, I'd like to personally invite you to become a member of a budding community on Patreon. By becoming a patron of the show, you can join me behind the scenes to discuss options for future guests, chat about things we've already heard, and gain access to some show swag. Details on how to become a patron can be found in the show notes. I'd love for you to join me. Okay, on with today's show. Forgive me, I want to pull the curtain back a little bit and look behind, right? Is for me, I will sometimes do presentations. You know, there's a lot of effort that goes into it and a lot of emotion. You know, you want to be good. You know, you want to resonate with the audience. But on your level, what I imagine is transcontinental flights, arriving, jet lagged, hotel room for weeks. And when the alarm goes off in the morning, going, I have to bring it today. You know, you're fighting fatigue, which is the enthusiasm killer, both mentally and physically, to be day after day after day. How do you do this?
I've got very strict with my time, my valuable time, when it's my time and when it's not. For me, work is when somebody else has bought my minutes. So that's how I differentiate between what is work and what isn't. A lot of people say, oh, what you do, it's not work. You're just having a laugh. You're standing around. You're chatting. You're jumping. It's not work, which is fair enough. You know, it's not in a coal mine. I'm not digging coal out of the walls, out of the seams. But for me, work is when those minutes, those seconds do not belong to me. They belong to somebody else. Somebody has bought them, and I will give my 100%. But damn, James, when that stops, these are now my minutes and my seconds. And if that transport is late to get me to the hotel, there's hell to play. I do not appreciate my time being taken when I'm off work. So I will give everything, especially on a job that long. If the transport is not there for me, oof, they know about it. You know, every minute I am kept out of bed is valuable to me. So I need that rest. I need that time, especially when we do the balloon festival. That's always in December. And that's a tricky one. That's 2 days in one, really. It begins at 3 a.m. and we do a live show at breakfast at sunrise from the balloon basket every morning. So we fly with all the balloons, 50 or 60 balloons, and then we land. Then we get back to the hotel. We have breakfast. I get back in bed. And so then I can sleep then from 11 a.m. till 3 p.m. And then I'm up again and I'm on stage at 4 p.m. till 10 p.m. And then I'm back in bed at 10 p.m., 11 p.m. So I sleep from 11 till 3 twice a day. But those times are, you know, for instance, I've had a situation where I finished the morning flight and one of the teams just said, oh, we're going to go and visit the fish market or the museum of things. Do you want to come along? I said, no, I need to get back to the hotel. I need to go to bed. And they said, no, come on, it'll only be, you know, half an hour. I said, this half an hour is extremely valuable to me. You could not give me $1,000 for this half an hour. I need to be in bed. I need to, you know, you don't understand. I'd rather just get an Uber than be held back another 5 minutes. So yeah, time becomes very, very valuable.
What was the point whereby you go from, man, I'm just so glad to be getting hired. Let's go. Yeah. And then there was a point going, I'm a professional at this.
Yeah.
I imagine you may have been like me when I was getting started, but I was so glad to be hired that I really undervalued what I was billing.
Yes.
And then there came a point going, wow, I need to make a living from this. I need to charge appropriately. But because it was skydiving, I would often undersell. And only when someone started literally timing how many hours I might have on a project and go, your hourly wage is so low compared to how much time you're putting in, you're going to go crazy or go bankrupt one way or the other at the pace. So was there a moment when the penny dropped where you're like, okay, the mentality is I'm not happy to be here and happy to be hired, but I'm a professional and you're paying for my minutes. That's a very distinct change in thinking.
Yes. Well, for sure, when I resigned from Impura Brava and went freelance when I moved to Dubai, that was a big change because all of a sudden I was working in environments which weren't from airsports. I was doing MC gigs outside of what we are normally used to. And so then there's a different rate, you know, than I was in touch with and networking with people who were not from our end of the world, not from our end of sports, if you like. They were from different environments. So then I realized, you know, there's a different price there. Of course, skydiving events do have their own rate, you know, and it is different than what you can get in the real world, as we say. But there was a funny conversation with a tunnel competition that was trying to hire me. I gave them a day rate and they said, oh, that seems a lot. I said, do you know these tunnel competitions are about 18 hours? Do you want to divide that by 18 and see if you're going to earn more in McDonald's or more with you? You know, so sometimes people don't quite realize what you're giving and what you're putting forward. But for sure, when I became freelance and working with the real market forces, I realized the value of what I was doing. Working a lot in the Middle East, of course, with Qatar and with Dubai, you know, the budgets are more realistic. So, yeah. And like you said, putting in those hours, giving the value and getting older and realizing what I do bring, because anybody now can pick up a microphone. Anybody can do a Facebook video. Anybody can do an Instagram story. But there's I know what I can bring. And I know what that's worth.
You and I were just in Poland. You were the MC for the European Skydiving Symposium. And without question, as I observed and appreciated the event and the organizers, the investment, whatever that was, in having you there was 100% worth it because it sets the energy for the day. It sets the tone. The MC is the accompaniment or sets up the speakers, you know, to get everybody who's going from one seminar to the next to okay, energy up. Energy up. Let's go, everybody. And then, of course, the daily videos that you produce. It's like, wow, Regan is absolutely, this is not just an MC. This is setting the tone for the brand of the event. You're helping with its brand. We want to be there. We want to feel that energy, that excitement. Yeah, it was really good, Regan.
There's a lot of tricks to it. There's a lot of, it can sometimes look a lot easier than it is. And I've seen many people try to do it. And some of the common mistakes that people make is thinking it's about them, thinking they have to be funny, thinking they have to be clever, thinking they have to be sarcastic or talk down about other people. I see people doing this all the time, you know, trying to be MCs or trying to be live stream presenters. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's not about me trying to be hilarious. It's not about me trying to be funny. It's about setting the tone, as you say. It's about making people welcome, putting people at ease. And these are all the skills I've learned over the years. I've been doing it 20 years now. So, you know, that's, I know my value. I know what I can bring. And I'm glad that people hire me for it.
Do you ever feel fearful or insecure in that when you are freelancing, you now have to fill your pipeline of business? You know, I imagine through 20 years, there are periods where, ooh, upcoming jobs look a bit dry. Need to make something happen. Has it ever been that way or has it always been continuous?
I've been quite fortunate that it's been quite continuous. And now it's good. I don't have any problem at all. My books are quite full with what I need. In fact, there's many, many opportunities come along, which I just can't do because there's a date clash. You know, one, for instance, this year, which is so frustrating. It's the Hot Air Balloon World Championships and the Gas Balloon World Championships are both at the same time. which that's a big mistake from the ballooning community. I don't know why they've done that. So they've kind of dropped themselves on the foot there. So that I can't do both of those. In fact, that particular week, there's four jobs I could have done, which I can't do. But getting back to your question about the work, do I worry about it not being there? Not really. I mean, if I'm not working at all, I can be painting. I've got my paintings that I sell. If I got a year without any work, to be honest, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I think it'd be nice to have a little bit of time off. But I'm okay. I'm okay with work right now.
People would assume you're an extrovert. Many people think that I am. I'm an introvert. Are you a natural extrovert, or are you introverted needing to bring the energy?
I really, really value my own time. I like to be at peace. I like to be not alone as such, but the kind of the sanctum of being in the house on the evening. We've had some food, we've got a drink, we're maybe going to watch a movie, and that type of thing. That is very, very precious to me. That is very, very valuable. I really enjoy my job. I really enjoy what I do. I'm very much into being the person in charge of what's happening as opposed to being the person who's being entertained. I'm very hard to entertain. You know, if I'm in a situation where I'm meant to be entertained, I probably won't enjoy it. You know, I don't get involved in any pre-organized yearly, you know, like the New Year's Eve thing or the certain celebrations that everybody wants to do, Halloween, that type of stuff. I'd rather be helping other people have a good time than trying to have a good time on those moments. So Christmas, for instance, Christmas and New Year, I think from being 16, there's four of those that I've not worked. So that's almost 40 years. I've been working in the pub trade or on a drop zone or now with MCing. So I've always been there. For me, my worst nightmare would be to go to some event or restaurant or something on a New Year's Eve where we've got to have a good time and you're putting on the smile. You know, I would rather be at home, or I'd rather be on stage. First of all, I'd rather be on stage. Secondly, I'd rather be at home. But I would absolutely refuse to be somebody there being entertained. That's not for me at all.
Of your work, something that I really got connected to was the Gordon Bennett balloon race.
Yeah.
The one that you did from New Mexico, being the host of this race. I was not familiar with the race or the rules or anything, but I got so hooked into that, Regan. I was following you every day and really got quite invested in the teams that were racing across the country.
Yeah, everybody says this.
And understanding a little, it was amazing.
It is, isn't it? My first experience with it, I was doing a FAI event in Switzerland. It was a general conference followed by a drone conference. So I was emceeing both of those. And Marcus Haguenay, I will never forget what he did for me, because he was always been a big supporter of me through the FAI. And he said, "What are you doing next week? Are you free?" And I said, "I am, actually." He said, "I want to take you to Gruyère in Switzerland." I said, "What for?" I said, "The Gordon Bennett." And I said, "What?" Because in English, for an English person, Gordon Bennett is an exclamation. It means like something's extraordinary. Gordon Bennett. And it actually comes from the guy.
I've heard my mum exclaim that many, many times.
So the guy who invented the race, Gordon Bennett, he was a New York newspaper mogul. And so he had all this incredible wealth. And the first thing he sponsored was a yacht race. And then he sponsored a car race. And then he sponsored this balloon race, the Gordon Bennett. And it's the Gas Balloon World Championships. They take off with full fanfare, with national anthem, with crowds of people, and they fly off into the night. And it's who can get the furthest away from where they take off, they're the winner. And the record is four nights in the basket. It's like four nights in a small lavatory-sized room. In you go, off you go, thousands of miles. And whoever lands the furthest away, not who flies the furthest, because you could fly far away and then get wind, which brings you back. It's the measuring points from start to landing. And that furthest distance is the winner. And it's incredible, the skill that's involved, the meteorology, the planning, the preparation, that night of the launch. What are you going to do? There might be some wind heading east already there, but there might be tomorrow, there might be a stronger wind going east. So if you can find a way just to hang on here overnight, you know, stay at a certain altitude, which is going to keep you there, and then catch that next wind tomorrow. It's incredible, the preparation of it. But the launch is something very emotive. You've got a certain number of teams, say between 20 and 30 teams, that are all taking off. And you might have 10, 20, 30,000 people there. So it's a great atmosphere. This year in Albuquerque, New Mexico, it was part of the Balloon Fiesta race. So we had 100,000 people there. There was a million people over 9 days at that event. And on the launch in the evening, to be the MC for that in America with the American teams, with 100,000 people, I'm tingling now just thinking about it. You know, given the honor of being the guy on the mic, you know, not being an American, so an English guy on the microphone announcing the teams, the American teams, please welcome team number 8. It's Mark Sullivan and Sherry White as they head off into the sky. And I've got these bios of them. I'm reading out the bios and I've got an iPad in one hand. I've got a mic in the other. I'm looking down a camera lens. There's somebody with a light in my face. I'm trying to watch the team. I'm trying to time my bio to match their procession to be put onto the center podium. And then the race director, he's checking the weight of the balloon and getting everybody to get their hands off. And as he lets go, that's when the national anthem has to start. So I've got to do the bio. I've got to cue the guy to set off the national anthem and make it all seamless in front of 100,000 people. It was incredible. The roar as they took off, the USA team won, as they went to the sky, the roar which erupted, 100,000 people in that patriotic energy. Man, I will never forget that. It's probably the most spine-tingling thing I've ever done.
I felt it. And I was like, wow, I would love to go to that. It was extraordinary. Regan, I'm going to pivot for a moment. 2012, Dubai puts on the world meet for skydiving, and none of us in the world of skydiving had ever seen anything like it. And I love chatting to people that were there or who have spent time, you know, Craig and Ileana for years thereafter. And you've seen an awful lot with your time there. But is there a story where even you were surprised by this off-the-wall opulence that is like, wow, even that is beyond imagination?
Well, it's got to be the closing ceremony and the famous case of the Katy Perry concert. So there was rumors flying around that for the closing ceremony, there was going to be some celebrity there. And that rumor had been going for a couple of years because it was now in the third year of the championships. And it came to light, it was going to be Katy Perry. And she was going to be performing for us all for the closing ceremony, which is like, for a skydiver, are you serious? So they've got a big stadium there. They've got the maiden race course stadium where we were going to be, where the concert was going to be held. And so what is it, 2,000, 3,000 skydivers? We all get bussed up to this stadium. It all kind of went a little bit downhill from there because we had no idea that there might be some alcohol available. You know, we thought maybe we might get a beer, maybe not, probably not. And we arrived and we're getting off the coaches, walking into this place, and dotted around was just waiters standing around with trays with a variety of different drinks, different colours and things. So we thought maybe it's some orange juice, some apple juice, some water. And I walked over and I said, oh, so what have you got here? He said, hello, sir. He said, red wine, white wine, gin and tonic, beer, whiskey. So you can see all these skydivers. In a normal world, somebody might go, oh, thank you so much, sir. Take a glass of wine, a glass of champagne, and start chatting. 2,000 skydivers descended on these waiters because we assume this is the only drinks we're going to get. So everybody's scrambling. You know, it was like something off a war zone. People are grabbing drinks, taking them down, shoving them under their armpits, trying to get two or three at once. It was incredible. And then the waiter was like, no, it's okay, don't panic. The bar is open. So then we're all looking for money and credit cards. He said, no, the bar is yours tonight. The bar is open, the bar is free. You can imagine what happened, how that went. 2,000 skydivers with an open bar. OMG, it was quite the night. I think I still have an injury on my elbow from it, I remember coming home on the buses, back to the coaches, back to the hotel. And I remember at one point, people crowd surfed. I was being crowd surfed from the back of the bus to the front of the bus, and then back to the back of the bus, and then back to the front of the bus. They were kind of surfing me. And they dropped, at one point, they dropped me onto the driver of the bus. There was somebody else from a four-way team. I won't mention his name, but he was up, you know, in the where you put your bags in, the bags at the top of the coach thing. They had him in there. It was just absolutely insane. It was insane. In fact, where we were just were in Poland at the symposium, Bill Booth was there, of course. And I've got a picture on my phone of me and Bill Booth standing somewhere behind the race course, looking quite dishevelled as we were singing Fly Me to the Moon by Frank Sinatra in front of a crowd of about 50 people. What a great memory that was. So that was probably one of the most opulent scenes of skydiving that there's probably ever been and ever will be.
Remarkable. What a time. What a time.
What a time to be alive.
This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. Now, I'm not a fan of lots of ads during a podcast. I mean, who likes ads? So I'll stop talking about how marvelously wonderful Beyond Marketing is. But if you're curious about what the amazing people of Beyond Marketing do to help drop zones and manufacturers thrive, then you should check out their website at dropzone.marketing. That's dropzone.marketing. Regan, another big highlight is you've been paired up with Rich Grimm. He brings you to the Tsunami Boogies. I don't even know how to ask this question because it's probably not a fair question to ask, but of all the jumps you've done in these exotic locations, when you reflect on them, is there one that, oh, that one was great. I would do that again in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious answer is the Blue Hole jump, of course, but there's other ones which are maybe even more special in my memory. The one we've just done in the Seychelles, the jump onto Bird Island. There was something very special about that, very special. So Bird Island, it's roughly around 60 miles off the coast, off from the Seychelles, up to the, I think it's northwest. I'm sure somebody will check this and tell me I'm wrong. But it's just this island which has got a few little cabins on there. There's no dock. You can't bring a boat into there. It's beautiful white beaches. And the birds, it's just full and full of birds from many, many different varieties. So that jump onto there is quite special. One, because you're flying out over 50 miles over sea in a single engine aircraft. So it's quite, you know, the nerves are up there a little bit. And then the landing there on this beautiful white sand that I've never seen the state of, the juxtaposition with that to this turquoise, millions of different turquoises of the water. That was very special. We, in the Palau boogie, we went to Palau in the South Pacific and we jumped onto the Peleliu Island, which was famous from the World War, and we were the first people to land on there. Kay Cocker off Belize, we were the first people to land on that, which is probably the best day in skydiving ever. We jumped onto this island in front of all the school kids. We had an incredible welcome. They took us on golf carts down to this lazy lizard spit at the end of the island there, where we had a cocktail party in the beautiful blue waters with a DJ, and then we took a catamaran with rum back to San Pedro on Belize. That was an incredible experience. Alaska, the Alaska boogies with Rich, incredible again. Nicaragua being the first people to jump into Nicaragua in front of the dignitaries there. But the blue hole jump, that is very something special. That is something special. I've done that twice. Again, you're flying out over water for a long, long time. You're jumping out of the plane. I think the last one I was wearing swimming shorts, a T-shirt, and my rig and my goggles. That was it. No altimeter, no digital. Just, you know, you just kind of fall for a little bit, open your parachute, and then land it in the water. So that's a very special jump. And I think every jump on those boogies, it's a very different type of boogie, James, that we do with Rich. You know, it's a lot of skydiving now is quite intense. It's quite performance led. You know, it's invitationals, it's skill camps, it's debriefs, it's skill based, it's performance, it's all these things. It's a lot of pressure for people, and these boogies are not. You get out of the plane, you all get together, you land, and you have the best time ever. It's nothing to do with the skydive. It's nothing to do with the skydive. It's nothing to do with, oh, we did so many points, or we did this amazing formation. If that's what you want from your jumping, it's not the event for you. There's plenty of events like that. This is about the skydive is just something to give you the opportunity to see these incredible places. So, for instance, when we jumped over the Bird Island, there was five of us, I think, and one of the guys says, so what we're going to do on this jump? I said, we're going to stare at the island, of course. What do you think we're going to do? I don't want to be looking at you. So we get together and we just spend the whole minute turning a little bit and looking down at the incredible water, the incredible island, and just seeing where we were. We're over this water and the island's over there. You know, you've put your trust into all your training and all your years, and you've got the trust in the pilot that he's put you out in the right place, that you're just going to make it back to there. I think I put something on Twitter, you know, absolutely overawed by the incredible outrageousness of what you're doing in that moment. Falling through the sky over the top of the ocean with an island in your vision off to the side, which you know you're going to land on. So that's what that skydive's all about, holding onto each other and watching and feeling that experience, not about turning points.
Regan, there can be no better gig in the world of skydiving ever.
Yeah.
But cannot be.
No.
You're very lucky.
I know.
Very fortunate. But I think your luck isn't by chance. It's not luck. It's you've put in, you know, you've put your innings in and you're getting rewarded for it.
And you know, the funny thing is, James, all these moments that we've talked about, all these moments of pivot, all these moments of opportunity, it's still happening. There's something I'm dealing with right now, which I can't talk about at the moment. And it's another thing that I've been invited to do. And my first impression always is, I can't do it, I can't do it. But then I think, yes, I can, because I've done all these other things, and it's just another one that I can do. You know, it's ongoing, always ongoing.
Oh, it's so exciting. Okay, you have had the benefit of observing the world's greatest skydivers in pretty much every discipline. You watch, you observe. Who impresses you?
Bruno Brucken impresses me. Pete Allam impresses me. All the airspeed guys impress me, from the old ones to the new ones. Some great colleagues of mine that I work with a lot. Anna Moxness is just an incredible human being. The things she gets to do, and she's a performer as well, so I'm very impressed with her. We're on a dangerous route here, James LeBarry, talking about people that impresses us, because for sure, after the call, I'm going to say, why didn't I say that person? But there's many people in the sport who've been around for a long time. That's what impresses me. People that are still doing it, still performing. People who are still bringing it. I'm just thinking now of people that have been around recently. Tom Sanders, of course, great friend of mine, Tom. Rich Grimm, you know, the opportunities he's brought to the world around us. So many skydivers impress me that it's hard, and it's a difficult thing to start naming them. You know, Kirk, Dan BC, all these airspeed people there, the young guys, Hayabusa, of course, the guys from Hayabusa. They've been through so many iterations of that team. Brought so many things forward, the free fly people which have took the sport through incredible changes. Andy Malchiori especially, another good friend who's very different than me. Andy's very quiet, very withdrawn with his personality, but he's an entertaining gentleman indeed, a very good friend. So there's a lot, and now I'm panicking about people that I've said and that I haven't said, and there's going to be hell to play. But yeah, those are just a few names that spring to the top of my mind. So I think, as a general rule, anybody that's been around for quite a few decades who's still bringing it, you know, they are very impressive. Pete Allam, of course, is one of the strongest. You know, Pete Allam has just reinvented himself time and time again when it comes through the sport of skydiving. Started off as a four-way and then with free fly and canopy piloting and wingsuit and all the projects he does as well. Yeah, Gustavo Cabana, again, reinvented himself as just a camera flyer from big waves and world championships. Now he's a free flyer who films all the big free fly stuff. Yeah, I think anybody who's got humility in what they do, who's humble in what they do, who recognizes their talent but doesn't shout about it too much, they impress me.
All right, I must ask this for my own personal curiosity. You're a professional traveler, let's face it.
Yeah.
What are some travel hacks that make traveling much easier, that your essentials in your routine?
All right, so there's a few. One, make sure you've got lounge access, and make sure, if you can, that you've got status with one particular airline, because that makes so, so much difference. You know, a day of travel, there's many points in that which can be a point of frustration. So queuing up, lining up to check your bags, that can be a point of frustration. So if you can possibly get yourself in a situation where you can get priority check-in, that's going to make a big difference in your life. If you can buy fast track to get through the airport, buy it. You know, getting through security, that makes a big difference. Get yourself a credit card, which gives you lounge access, or get priority pass or one of the other multi-lounge passes. That makes a big difference. Being able to just sit down, have a piece of quiet, maybe get a shower, bite to eat. Now, travel hacks for people that might not have access to those things. Get a window seat. I used to always get an aisle seat because you can get to the bathroom quicker. But now I've decided window is better, because what you can do, you can make yourself a little bed. So what I do, I have a neck pillow. And neck pillows, people wear them wrong most of the time. They'll have them fastened at the front with the kind of thick bit at the back. It's backwards. You should turn it round. The thick bit should be at the front, so your chin goes down onto that. Then you want a thick cardigan or a pullover, which you can then fold up into a very, very comfortable thing which goes against the window. So you've got your head against the window. You've got your pillow to rest your neck. That means your legs can go out at 45 degrees, still keeping them in your part of the, you're not crossing over into the middle seat, but you've got a bit of leg stretch. And then a quality eye mask. Get on Amazon, find the most beautiful cotton eye mask for $20 and get yourself one of those. Try to avoid alcohol on a day of travel, because it makes such a big, big difference. We all like to have a little glass of wine or a beer when we get to the airport, and then a couple of somethings on the plane. But if you're traveling for a full day, if you don't drink alcohol, if you don't drink fizzy drinks, just drink water, keep hydrated, and get yourself there as best you can. That's some of the hacks I can possibly think of.
Well, how do you deal with jet lag?
Oh, it's hard, man. There's nothing you can do about it, you know. Jet lag is one of those things that you've just got to kind of fight through. And in fact, next week I'll go to China for the Indoor World Championships. I'm presenting that with Anna. And that's quite a big time difference from here. It's going to be a 13-hour flight down to Singapore and then a flight down to Macau in China. And what I'm trying to do this week now, leading up to that, I'm trying a new hike. I'm resetting my clock an hour and a half every day. So I'm getting up earlier, going to bed earlier. So eventually, the day before I travel, I should be on their time. I should be starting my day at 2 a.m. and going to bed at 4 p.m. And hopefully that's going to be some way of trying to get a head start on the jet lag. I don't know if it's going to work. We'll see.
Interesting.
I've never tried it before. But, you know,
I would imagine that takes discipline too, trying to do that so many weeks ahead while trying to enjoy the day, really.
Yeah, well, it's going to be just one week. But, you know, at some point you're going to have to deal with it. You have to deal with it there where you're trying to present, or I can deal with it now where I can just put my eye mask on, get in bed at 5 p.m. or 4 p.m. or whatever it is, 3 p.m. and just try and sleep. Because at some point, that problem is going to be either now or next week, and I'd rather try and get rid of it now.
Okay, last question, Regan. The path in professionalism in skydiving usually is packer, manifest, instructor, maybe DZM, DZO. That's like, I want to work in skydiving. You've been able to avoid most of that.
Yes.
If someone were to come to you and say, look, give me some advice. I want to make a living in skydiving, but I don't want to go the traditional route. What do you tell them?
It's a good question. I get asked it a lot. You know, I'm fully sponsored with all my equipment. Everything I wear and jump with is from, you know, all the best companies. And people see that and they say, how do I get sponsored? How do I get all this? Well, you've got to make yourself valuable, haven't you? You've got to give something. It's not about just getting somebody to give you free shit. That's what a lot of people, how do I get something for free? You're not getting anything for free. You're working harder than you've ever worked in your life. But how do you get onto the system without doing all that? It's difficult, James. If you're young, if you are late teens, early 20s, get to a drop zone, do some packing. Start off that way. Another thing which just sprung to mind, I know for a fact that the cruise ships that have the wind tunnels on, they're crying out for staff. They can't get enough people to work in those tunnels. If I was starting again now, that is a route I would do. I would go and join one of the cruise ships. They will train you to be a tunnel instructor. You will learn all your skills. You're getting to work on a cruise ship. You're getting to see the world a little bit. Do that for a few years. You've got your rating. You're a tunnel rated instructor, and the world is your oyster. You can go and work anywhere in the world as a tunnel instructor. That leads on to skydiving work should you want it to, but it doesn't necessarily have to. That's my top advice. Anybody listening now who wants to get out of the real world, run away and join the circus like we have, get in touch with the cruise ships that have got the wind tunnels and get yourself on there. Let them train you to be a tunnel instructor. See the world for a little bit. See what happens on cruise ships and then take your life from there.
Regan, this has been an enlightening hour and a bit. I'm so grateful for your time. I'm inspired by you because of your flexibility to say yes. Every time you do, the doors open. And I think there's lessons for us all to be learned from how the standard way that you live your life. I don't even think it's conscious for you, but it's very conscious for many of us. So it's almost as if just say yes. And as you said, worst case scenario, I'll go get me a job.
Yes, there's always that, right?
Cheers, Regan. I can't wait to see what you're going to be into this year. Can't wait to see what this thing you're working on is. I'm sure it'll be very evident when I'm confident that you will land it. And I really can't wait if you're doing Gordon Bennett again.
Yes, I am.
To get into that. I hope you are.
I am indeed. Germany, September. We'll see you there.
Super. Thank you so much.
Thank you, James.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the 20 Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode, which is released every Monday. If you want to contact the team, our email address is podcast@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Znydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies Fun Days. Thanks for listening and join us next week for our next episode.